are people saying. So there are these two paths, you could say, or two types of conversations largely happening. One are the media reports, which do not have a well enough source of citation, so they are not credible enough. The other thing is what is being which is properly quoted and coming from a respectable source, and that is very important because that's what we base our policies on. Now, these two do not often converge is the big problem for me personally. And then being an Indian, I bring my personal experience, which at times comes very contradictory to the kind of conversations we are having. Because when I formally started researching this topic, I was very confident that this is right up my alley. I know about it firsthand. And so it's pretty clear to me that this is what is happening. But the more and more I started looking into it, the more confusing it became, primarily because of different discourses that come into play and different meanings that we give to words. So, for example, the word that you used, feticide or feticide, is very politically charged, but only when we talk about it with respect to the abortion debate. If you look into medical literature, they use the word feticide as a very neutral word, which is just a clinical medical procedure that ensures that the fetus is dead before it's delivered. So, I mean, at times, I've even wondered, so this is a problem that either has no name, or it will have a name, but the name will be a string of adjectives, which, coming from a creative writing background, I'm totally against. How would you like, Andy, if I described you as, hey, man with the red shirt, how are you doing? So it's like I'm negating the problem in the first instance. So that's been a personal conflict that's been going within me. And I'm not too sure what exactly to call it to kind of attract the attention of people to the problem itself and not the confusing discourses that are surrounding against it. So as I like to put it, it's actually dwarfing the problem that is gender imbalance. And we don't need to prove anything now. The numbers which sociologists pride over so much, the data, 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 and that's the most objective form of research, right? So the data is giving you the story. This is what it looks like. And I go to India every year. I don't know what the situation will be now when I go back. It's definitely degraded more. But at times I feel what's the confusion? You know what the state is. Why not give it a name that is acceptable? And the interesting thing is the researchers and the scholars are talking about it. There are activists on the ground who are talking about it. There are women who have gone through this thing who are talking about it. And all these conversations, they are talking about the same thing, but they are talking about it in different ways. Some come across as very subjective and connoting different meanings, so they are discarded by some other people.
Where do you think needed change can and might take place? I mean, is there a forum? Is it a public health issue?
It is a public health issue. Yeah, it is a public health issue. It is of prime importance to demographers. And I read a working paper by somebody who's working at Harvard. She's writing about it. So it's again a very interdisciplinary issue. So feminist economists are talking about it. Economist Amartya Sen was the first person, I believe, who alerted the world to the issue of missing women. And he left it there. But he was we say that there are 50% men and 50% women in the world, which is not true, because what we are primarily doing is generalizing what we see the phenomena as occurring in Europe and North America, the global north. But that's not the story when you look toward other countries, and specifically India and China,
the two most populous nations in the world.
Exactly. And that's when the conversation began. And at the beginning of this question, you said, like, what can people do or something of that sort. That is exactly what even the United Nations is asking for people to do, or even the registrar of the Census Bureau in India. They need more data, and there is reliable data at the national level in India, but in terms of regional level, more reliable data is required. So more research into what is exactly that people are saying about it. Because I can say things from my experience, but who am I and why would you accept what I'm saying? So my next step ties very well into it, because I'll be traveling to India this summer, and I'm going to do research where I'm collecting data from people from different sections of the society. Because the more I have talked about it with even like people who are Americans, and I did not suspect at all that they would have anything to do with this issue, there are these stories and narratives that come out which really, really surprise you. So the ethnographic method of like unstructured interviews where you don't ask the question like, did you abort a fetus? Who in their right mind are going to say yes?
Right.
If I look at my culture, I don't think anybody would admit to it until and unless they are in very severe circumstances where they have nothing to lose.
Mm.
Those are the women who come out and say that, yes, we have done it. So, I mean, asking creative questions to women or to people in general and gathering that data and drawing conclusions from that is probably going to contribute more, because the stories of people are really different. Like, there was recently a show on Indian TV where these stories really came up. I mean, there is controversy around the words they are using, but I mean, nothing changes the issue. The fact remains that there are 914 girls per 1,000 boys. That does not change. So,
and it's a number that's continuing to decline.
That's continuing to decline.
Yeah.
I mean, there are three census, population census, that are often reported, often quoted in reports and like even research media, and that number is declining. Since like 1947, that number has been on the decline.
Hmm. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Talk at the Table. I'm your host, Andy Morikawa. I'm here in the studio with my guest, Manisha Sharma. We're going to take a short break and come right back. We're going to listen to Come to My Table by Shannon Stevens on her album, The Breadwinner.
You've got one crazy blood.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Talk at the Table. I'm your host, Andy Morikawa. I'm here in the studio with my guest, Manisha Sharma. And before the break, Manisha, we were talking about, you had brought up the Nobel laureate who had been the first really to point to this problem of the missing girls phenomenon. And I wanted you, if you would, for just a moment, for our listeners, explore this desperate desire to have a son in India. I mean, such that with the knowledge that a pregnancy might bear a girl, that the parents would abort that fetus, hoping that they would be able to have a boy. What is this desire, this deep, deep desire about?
So there is this desperate, deep desire to have a son, to bear a son, and that is so embedded into the culture that you cannot distinguish it, and you cannot like pinpoint that this is the thing that it's happening because of. Some of the things which are pretty apparent, and I have seen it firsthand too, is like even in like the last religious rites of a person, according to scripture or according to the rituals, they must be performed by a male heir. So if you don't have a boy, someone else's, like maybe your the distant, maybe some family relative's boy will do it. Now that said, there are always exceptions where women are doing these things. I'm primarily talking about the Hindu community in India, which is where I come from. So that becomes one thing. Another thing which is very practical, and that often confuses me, like, you know, if people are doing it, why will they not do it? When I call my parents back home and I see that my brother is living with them, which is not considered bad in India. It's a good thing if your child is living with you. He's supporting my parents who are now old and are not capable of doing the things they were doing when they were in their 40s. So he's financially supporting the family. He's emotionally and mentally also supporting the family. My mother is happy that there is somebody. If I were to fall down today, I know that he'll come and take care of me. So that's another very practical reason to have a son, because a daughter can very well do all these things that a son is doing, but it's still not socially very acceptable in most of the country. Mm. But what really happens is, like, I really like when Nikki Giovanni says that we need to repeat certain things even if we know them very well. Because when you don't repeat certain things, you forget, and very soon they become like some of the superstitions. You do it. Why do you do it? We don't know. Because my mom said, and my mom said, and my grandmom said, I do it. But if you start unearthing and deconstructing some of the superstitious beliefs also, there are certain very valid reasons behind it. So I really worry that if we do not address this issue like that, it has actually already become like that. Because if very literate people who understand every single thing continue to engage in this practice of sex selection, it is pretty soon gaining those monstrous dimensions that, you know, we just do it. And it is not very socially acceptable that I, being a daughter, am sending financial help to my parents. They will not accept it socially. Even if they do, in a majority of cases, it'll be hidden. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of social issues that are surrounding this. And it's been like so old that you cannot slice it off and break that shell in a few years.
Where do you see, or do you see, signs of hope?
Well, if you ask me personally, I think because the issue is so complex, it needs to make sense to every possible person. So everyone doesn't think the same way. For me, images make a lot of sense. For you, sound makes a lot of sense. For someone else, touch makes a lot of sense. So if we bring these senses and address, like, talk to more people, have more narratives or more stories where, you know, you are talking about the issue, but you are not talking about the issue at the same time. So in normal conversations, and address it in as many forms as possible. So like a lot of people are doing documentaries on the issue. That attracts Bill Gates, and he starts thinking about it and says that, oh, I'm going to fund this. Because I recently read in a newspaper that he was mighty impressed by the TV program that talked about this issue, and he wanted to meet the guy who produced or directed this program. So, you know, you never know what strikes who. Like, I might look at a painting and get completely transformed, or I might go to a play and I have that effect, cathartic effect, that changes me completely. Now, nobody told me to change, but when I saw Macbeth, something happened in me, a transformation happened in me, that when I step out of that theater, I'm a totally changed person.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think, because, I mean, I don't have to say anything. It's proven, because it's not like people in India are just sitting quiet. There's lots of talk about it. Everybody knows about it. And thanks to the TV program, a vast majority of people know about it. The TV is there in every household now.
Mm-hmm.
So more people know about it. There's been lots of talk among feminist groups, non-feminist groups, NGOs. The government is doing a whole lot. There are laws in place. State governments are doing a lot. But there is this disconnect that, you know, in spite of so much happening, the numbers continue to decline. And that's a big evidence that, you know, not much is happening. So everyone, like, you know, I'm good at art. I might represent it in the form of art. So as many mediums as we can use, somewhere something has to come up, because if there's a problem, there will be a solution, right?
Yeah. You have in listening to you, I have a sense that it's a problem that people intellectually can appreciate and perhaps even agree. Yet when it comes to their own personal circumstance, things might change.
Yeah. I mean, I don't even know, like, how my own parents, how did they deal with things? Because, I mean, they know it very well that, you know, raising three girls in India is not easy, along with raising a boy as well. And you know that you have to marry them off, even if you are not engaging in dowry, which my parents never did. And there is some amount of money involved in getting a girl married, right?
Mm.
So, I mean, if you are making $5,000 a month and you're spending $4,800 every month and keeping $200 for, say, like certain things that might happen, somebody might get sick or something, $5,000 is also a pretty big number if I consider what my father's salary was. I mean, where do you save that money to get your daughters married off? So what you're doing, you're taking a loan, whereas you see this friend of yours who has saved all that money to get his married daughter married, or, like, I mean, they've been comfortable. I don't see my parents are very happy and content, and I guess that is more than physical comfort that you would have. It's not that they're poor. They're very comfortable now. But I'm pretty sure they might have thought about these things, that why are we doing it? And why are we doing it when everyone around us is doing something else? And pretty soon, when more people start doing something and that starts getting the stamp of society as being the right thing to do, and you are the only one who's doing this thing that you consider right, you need a lot of reinforcement, isn't it?
Yeah.
So if we just keep talking about negative issues that, you know, this is... the number is reducing big time. Where are you acknowledging those families that have, even in this, surrounded by this thick layer or thick whirlwind, and in the middle, at the center, in the nucleus, are these few families as compared to the rest who still went against the tide and did what they thought was the right thing to do?
Yes.
It is a very difficult thing, isn't it?
Indeed. And their children can tell the story.
Their children can tell the stories and must tell the stories.
Must. Well, what is the perspective of the different organized religions? How do the Hindus feel about it? How do the Muslims, do those communities come out either for or against, or do they take a stand? on the issue?
See, there has been research which says that this is like in the past, that there are certain communities which favor boys more than girls. But as recent as the 2011 census, it's like if you are comfortable, well-off, rich, you can be a Hindu, you can be a Christian, you can be a Muslim. It's the same. So we are very unified when we talk about sex selection, irrespective of our religious beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
And if you are poor, you can be from any religion. It doesn't make sense because I don't know if the poor were not poor, they probably would do the same thing. But if you are poor, you do not have the money to survive. You do not have the money to get 3 meals a day. So, I mean, would you really worry about that? Okay, I'll spend these 500 or 10 or 1,000 or 10,000 rupees getting an abortion done and finding out the sex of my fetus. That's not your major worry, isn't it? Putting food on the table is your only worry, the biggest worry, how will these things become important to you? They will not.
Mm-hmm.
So religion, there's like from my knowledge and my conversations with people who've been active in this field, there's like it's not divided according to religion. The rich in all religions, those that can afford, are getting into it.
Yeah. And then there are folks who, in appreciation, in recognition of their parents, are speaking out and are bringing to communities like ours the kind of work that you're doing. And I understand that you're going to be having a presentation or a display through the Institute for Creativity, Arts and Technology at the New Center for the Arts.
Yeah, sometime in the spring. The dates still need to be finalized. And I must also say that this, as we are talking about, like, if you read about this and the more you read, the more you get confused because the numbers keep changing. And the numbers keep changing because every few seconds a birth takes place. So you'll come across a wide variety of numbers. Some say there are 400,000 female fetuses being aborted by sex selection every year. Some say that number is 500,000. So those numbers confuse you, but you must realize that the bottom line is that, yes, there are sex determination tests being done, and as a result of that, female fetuses are aborted. That's remained constant.
Yeah, the enormity of it is staggering.
It is.
It really is. Mm-hmm. And the impact. I spent the last several days with my wife caring for our two grandsons while their parents were out of town. And it really helped me to see in a very close and intimate way how important my wife's role as the grandmother and mother is in our family. I mean, our family depends on it, the stability of our family and the sense of belonging, of trust that those little boys are developing is coming from her. And if she weren't there, I wonder who they would be or what they would become. And it just really brings home the gravity of the issue that you're choosing to draw our attention to and to help us realize that it's not just an Indian problem. It's not just a problem in China. It's a global issue.
It is a global issue. Yeah.
And I appreciate your coming and sharing that with us today.
Yeah. I mean, if you see, like, another discourse associated with it is, if you're talking about sex selection or female feticide, you're talking about abortion, and you're like, you're for against abortion or for abortion. There are several strands going on like that, but the bottom line stays that if there are no women, whose rights are we talking about?
Yes.
And if you go and talk to these women, they're not doing it because it is their choice. They're doing it because they're forced by certain circumstances.
Yes.
Or even by the cultural milieu, social milieu, and that is why they're doing it. So what question of choice are we talking about here?
Right.
Talks like this are only dwarfing the issue, making it smaller, and something that needs to be paid attention to just gets hidden under layers and layers.
Indeed. Manisha Sharma, thank you.
Thank you so much.
For being a guest on Talk at the Table. We're looking forward to you coming back in the fall with some of your students to further explore your work.
Sure. Thank you so much for giving me this opportunity.
You bet. It's been a real pleasure to have you here. So, again, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Talk at the Table. I'm your host, Andy Morikawa. And that's it for this week's show. Thanks again to Manisha Sharma. Thank you for tuning in. And remember, when it's Sunday, tune in at 2:30 to 3:30 here on WUVT-FM Blacksburg, the Valley's number one radio station. And until next week, keep talking community.
with you. Straight out my skull. Suddenly expression changes on the face of border guards. Lascia romanza provinta. Bola 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 na lobete. Bola 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 na codete. Asce crasce scei na frate. A tebe ruci per poverate. Laino. Yes!
everybody. Jamie Lee Curtis here for RAD, recording artists, actors, and athletes against drunk driving. What should you do to stop a friend from driving if they've been drinking? Answer, whatever it takes. Think before you drink. Designate before you celebrate. Choose a designated driver. Remember, friends don't let friends drive drunk.
A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Transportation, RAD, the National Association of Broadcasters, and the Ad Council.
WUBT. War. Stop a nuclear war.